It's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. This week, our top story is misplaced Republican priorities on display, and that's particularly regarding the economy and the poor and middle class. We then talk about the possibility of Senator Bernie Sanders running for president. Then we have choice excerpts from the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and the employment numbers. At the end, we'll have our trademark weekly hall of fame and shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to write to me and give me your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air. Again, that's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. My feature update on misplaced Republican priorities starts now. Ladies and gentlemen, as I mentioned earlier, this segment is titled Republican Priorities. This past week, Republicans on the House Ways and Means Committee, chaired by Republican Representative Dave Camp, refused to agree to a provision on House Resolution 4058 that would have provided a little over $1 million a year for 10 years for a total of $12 million for a program designed to keep at-risk foster children from entering a life of prostitution. Now, the argument that House Ways and Means Republicans gave was that it was too expensive and the outlays were not paid for in cuts or other ways, and I can understand that. Okay, I mean, all other things being equal, there are bills that Congress would find that would help people that they can't enact for a number of reasons, including budgetary ones. I mean, we are operating at a deficit. We have a large annual deficit. We have an overall debt that we're trying to pay off. So I understand that there are things that we would like to do that sometimes we can't. So I get that. All by itself, I can understand that. But when Republicans in the same committee, the House Ways and Means Committee, a few hours later, not even days, a few hours later, forced through a measure to give tax breaks to large corporations to the tune of, get this, $31 billion a year for 10 years, or a total of $310 billion. Then I've got a bit of a problem. And these are tax breaks for corporations like Apple and General Electric and Intel. Nothing wrong with those corporations. I mean, no corporation is perfect. I'm sure if we looked at each one, we could find things that we disagree with, things that we don't like. But I'm just saying, in general, there's nothing wrong with those corporations. And if it helps create jobs here in the U.S., I would be in favor of those tax breaks in general. But juxtaposed with what they did earlier in the day, refusing to allocate $12 million over a 10-year period to help at-risk children, and then turning around and giving $310 billion to tax breaks to large corporations. And to make matters worse, those same Republicans allowed the $310 billion bill to go through without adding any means to pay for those expenditures. No spending cuts, no tax increases, just more deficit spending. So where are Republican priorities? And I think it's valid to start really focusing in on that. I mean, we are within 6 months of Election Day in 2014, where the American people are going to get to decide which party is in charge of our federal legislature, our Congress. And priorities, I think, are a big part of that decision. Looks like the health care law isn't going to be as big of a factor in the election as it looked like it once was. So the American people, I think, are going to rightfully focus on priorities. And what does this decision by the Republican House Ways and Means Committee say about Republican priorities? $12 million over 10 years for kids, thrown out because it supposedly was too expensive and wasn't paid for, but $310 billion in tax breaks for corporations, also not paid for, that's okay. Now, a second thing happened this last week that sheds light on Republican priorities. Before I get into exactly what happened, I want to turn our collective memories back to February 2012. Do you all remember when Daryl Issa chaired a hearing on birth control for women? And there was a wonderful picture, well, wonderfully illustrative, if not angering, it made me very angry, made a lot of people very angry. About that hearing, there was a picture that showed five middle-aged gentlemen who were to be the folks to give testimony at that hearing regarding whether birth control for women should be covered by health insurance. No women were permitted to testify by Chairman Daryl Issa, Republican Chairman Daryl Issa. And one of the folks, if you'll recall, who Democrats tried to get to be one of the folks to give testimony at that hearing was Sandra Fluke, which of course led to the whole thing with Rush Limbaugh calling her a whore and a slut and all those other things, something that's still impacting his ability to get advertisers on his show today. And I think a lot of people rightfully asked the question, in a hearing that was designed to discuss whether women could have their birth control options covered by insurance, why aren't there any women testifying? Now, Republicans scrambled after that hearing and put together another one where they did have two women testify, and it turns out that those two women were employed by Christian universities, Oklahoma Christian University and Calvin College Health Services. So they finally did eventually find two women that they thought were okay to have testified on the subject, but of course they made every possible effort to ensure that those women would say exactly what they wanted them to say. The reason why I bring that up is because last week Paul Ryan, who chairs the committee that I'm about to talk about, had a hearing on poverty called A Progress Report on the War on Poverty, Lessons from the Front Lines. And as Think Progress reported, while it featured three experts, none of them are actually low-income Americans. So here we have a very similar situation to the hearing 2 years ago to discuss birth control choices for women. We have a hearing on poverty where no experts were actually low-income Americans. But Think Progress also notes that it's not for lack of trying that there were no poor Americans on that committee to testify. An advocacy organization called Witnesses to Hunger tried twice to offer some of their members who are below the poverty level to speak at Ryan's committee. They were refused. Paul Ryan refused to have these folks testify at his committee. And Think Progress reports that even though they reached out to Ryan's office, they did not immediately return a request for comment. And one final thing that I would mention to you when we talk about GOP priorities and things that happened in the last week. The Senate Republicans refused to allow debate on a bill to raise the minimum wage. They filibustered the opportunity to debate the minimum wage. Now, I can understand using rules of the body that you're a member of to block actual passage of various measures that you don't like. Those are the rules. You can't complain about people following the rules. But when you use the tools to block even discussion of a bill that is designed to pay people more than $7.50 an hour, $7.50 an hour, to raise the minimum wage, they would not even allow a discussion of that, Senate Republicans. So when you're thinking about who to vote for in this congressional election in 2014, even if you don't necessarily agree with where the Democrats come down on the issue, and obviously I do, I made that plain, I'm not trying to hide anything here, even if you don't necessarily agree with Democrats, though, how can you even consider Republicans serious voices and serious people to discuss the various issues that are important to America today? They don't have women to discuss women's issues. They don't allow them to discuss the issues in hearings. They don't allow the poor to discuss issues regarding poor people. These are not folks who should be in deciding, in positions of power to decide how issues of import to Americans are decided. We'll be right back. We don't get fooled again.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and it's the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentreprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentreprises.com. Scentreprises, our business makes you sensational.
Zero Juliet uploaded.
Welcome back. An article in Alternet this week talks about the potential run for president by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. And the article discussed whether Senator Sanders should run as a Democrat or as an independent. And actually, the article's title is, "Hey Bernie, if you're going to run for president in 2016, do it as a Democrat." I agree. It actually quotes Senator Sanders saying, "The dilemma is that if you run outside the Democratic Party, then what you're doing and what you have to think hard about is you're not just running a race for president, you're really running to build an entire political movement. In doing that, you would be taking voters away from the Democratic candidate and making it easier for some right-wing Republican to get elected. The Nader dilemma." Now, I think that's exactly right. I think if Bernie ran as an independent, Senator Sanders ran as an independent, I think it would be a big mistake. But I also, even though I'm a Hillary supporter, I've said that on the show many times, I'm a big Hillary Clinton supporter. I love Hillary. I think she's going to win. I think she's going to be a great president. But I think the entry of somebody like a Senator Sanders in the race on the Democratic side would actually be very healthy. I think the debate would be healthy. And I also think that Senator Sanders' focus on progressive ideas and the progressive position on various issues would be very helpful. I think he can make arguments that Hillary Clinton really doesn't want to touch, but would actually be effective in focusing the debate of the presidential contest on the Democratic side, on the Democratic way of looking at these issues. I think that he would make Hillary look very moderate. I think she looks moderate already, but I think he would really blunt the idea that Hillary is some sort of radical liberal. I think he would ruin that potential argument for the Republican nominee. And those type of issues that I would really be looking at Senator Sanders to focus on are really three top ones. And one of them is this idea of income and wealth inequality. There were some really good polls put out by Gallup, and they were discussed in an article on Common Dreams. And one of them in particular, the folks were polled on wealth inequality in the country. And they were polled on what they actually believed an ideal breakdown in terms of wealth by different portions of America would be. They were polled on what they estimated the actual breakdown in wealth is. And then there's a graph that put those two together along with the actual disparity in wealth in America. And the way it basically breaks down is what most Americans believe, 68%, in fact, believed that a little over 30% of wealth should go to the top 20%. The second 20th percent should have about another 22% of the wealth. The middle 20% should have about 20%. The fourth 20% of the population should have about 16%. And the bottom 20% of the country should have about 12% of the wealth. When they were asked what they think the actual wealth breakdown in the country was, they estimated that somewhere around 60% of wealth was owned by the top 20%. Another 22% or so was owned by the second 20th. About 12% was held by the middle 20th. About 5 to 6% by the fourth 20th, and the bottom 20% they estimated had about 3% of the wealth. Well, in actuality, the top 20% in this country have about 85% of the wealth. The second 20th wealthiest in this country have somewhere around 13% of the wealth. The middle 20% have somewhere around 4% of the wealth, and the rest of the people in this country have less than 1%. So the vast majority of this country, nearly 70%, believe that the wealth should be redistributed in a different way than what we have today, and actually think it's better than it currently is. And I think that that's something that Senator Sanders could speak to in a really, you know, positive and good way, in a way that the person who would be the eventual Democratic nominee could not. Because you saw what happened with President Obama. They're still calling him the guy that wants to redistribute wealth. If Senator Sanders does it, Hillary doesn't have to do it. So I think that would be very positive. The other thing that Common Dreams talked about, and this actually wasn't a Gallup poll, this was a Pew poll, talks about whether it's more important to reduce the deficit or do various other different things. In other words, whether it's more important to reduce the deficit or keep Social Security and Medicare benefits as they are, whether it's more important to reduce the deficit or keep spending for the poor at current levels, or whether it's more important to reduce the deficit or keep military spending at current levels. Now, here's the interesting thing. 69% of the population thought it was more important to keep Social Security and Medicare benefits as they are instead of reducing the deficit. Only 23% of the country thought it was more important to reduce the deficit than to keep those benefits as they are. 59% thought it was more important to keep spending for the poor at current levels, whereas 33% thought it was more important to reduce the deficit than spend money on the poor. 40% thought it was more important to keep military spending at current levels, where 51% of the country thought it was more important to reduce the deficit than keep military spending at current levels. So this is really basic progressive ideology. This falls right into where progressives are on these issues. And that's, again, something that Senator Sanders would be the perfect advocate for in a presidential race. Finally, approval of labor unions. Most of us, I think, have the idea that labor unions aren't very popular in the United States, and they certainly are less popular than they once were, but the impression I think a lot of us get is that more people disapprove than approve of labor unions, and that's simply not the case. Gallup's latest poll on this shows that labor unions are thought of favorably and are approved by 54% of the country, whereas 39% disapprove. Now, this is down from a high in the late 1950s. 75% approved of unions and only 14% opposed. But still, there is a significant difference. There's a significant level of approval over disapproval for unions in the United States. Again, this is something that would be perfect for a candidate Bernie Sanders. So, is there a downside to Bernie Sanders entering the race as a Democrat? Well, the downside would be if he and Hillary and their campaigns get into a personal war where they're slinging mud at each other, you know, they're making it about things other than the issues. I think if they keep the discussion on the issues, if Hillary is able to discuss center-left politics as she sees the way America should be led from a center-left viewpoint, and if Bernie Sanders concentrates on a progressive view of how America should be governed, I think we would have a great primary contest, and I think it would make Hillary much stronger for the general election. I like Senator Sanders. I like him. I think he's a great senator. I don't think he has a chance against Hillary. I don't think anybody has a chance against Hillary, but I think that race would be good for America. It would be good for liberals in the United States and progressives, and it would make Hillary an even stronger candidate, and it would really hamstring the Republicans' effort to cast her as a radical liberal. So I'm in favor of Bernie Sanders entering the race, but only if he enters the race as a Democrat. As he himself said, if he enters as an independent, what he's really doing is recreating the Nader dilemma and making it easier for a Republican to potentially beat Hillary. We'll be right back. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, B-A-D-L-E-R.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos.
Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R.
This past Saturday was the occasion of the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. The president was in rare form on Saturday and opened up with a few jokes about how challenging 2013 was for the White House.
I admit it. Last year was rough. Sheesh. At one point, things got so bad, the 47% called Mitt Romney to apologize. Of course, we rolled out healthcare.gov. That could have gone better. In 2008, my slogan was, yes, we can. In 2013, my slogan was, control, alt, delete.
As funny as that was, the problems with healthcare.gov seem so far away now, even for me. Folks, let me tell you, going on to conservative shows in October, November, and December, week after week, defending the issues with healthcare.gov was pretty tough work. It really was. I think that's some of the toughest work I've ever done in my life in any industry that I've worked in. Conservatives and Republicans were so tenacious with that issue. It was like trying to take a bone away from an angry large dog. But after that, the president decided to poke a little fun at some of the cable news channels.
I am happy to be here, even though I am a little jet-lagged from my trip to Malaysia. The lengths we have to go to get CNN coverage these days. I think they're still searching for their table. MSNBC is here. They're a little overwhelmed. They've never seen an audience this big before.
Poor MSNBC. That last one is going to leave a mark. Not sure if I would have said it, mind you, as most folks over there are probably on his side. So if I was the president, I'm not sure I'd want to piss them off too much. Of course, you know that at some point in the evening, there'd have to be a joke about Cliven Bundy, the Nevada rancher. Although how the president set it up, I don't think anybody saw it coming.
We have some other athletes here tonight, including Olympic snowboarding gold medalist Jamie Anderson is here. We're proud of her. Incredibly talented young lady. Michelle and I watch the Olympics. We cannot believe what these folks do. Death-defying feats. Haven't seen somebody pull a 180 that fast since Rand Paul disinvited that Nevada rancher from this dinner. As a general rule, things don't end well if the sentence starts, "Let me tell you something I know about the Negro." You don't really need to hear the rest of it. Just a tip for you.
Good tip there from the president. Don't start a sentence with, "Let me tell you about the Negro." Things are bound to go downhill from there. I've never seen a majority party and their friends in the media look so bad as the conservative pundits and Republicans look with this Cliven Bundy debacle. And I got to say, they really have no one to blame on that but themselves, right? I mean, if they had spent 2 minutes researching the guy, he has apparently made several racist statements in the past. They should have been able to see this coming. So, you know, Republicans and my friends on the conservative side of the media, privately, you know you didn't do your homework, so you deserved the egg on your face that you got here. Later, the president joked about his poll numbers.
Of course, now that it's 2014, Washington is obsessed on the midterms. Folks are saying that with my sagging poll numbers, my fellow Democrats don't really want me campaigning with them. And I don't think that's true, although I did notice the other day that Sasha needed a speaker at Career Day and she invited Bill Clinton.
Now that was funny, right? But the president's numbers are a total mystery to me. The economy is recovering strongly now. The numbers show that. They've been showing that. The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, is experiencing an upsurge in acceptance and favorability. 60% of Americans now want to keep it and fix any of the issues with it. Less than 30% want to repeal it. So how is that not translating to the president's approval? It doesn't make any sense to me. The only possibility that might make sense as far as that's all concerned is that somehow the president's approval numbers are lagging behind the approval and support of some of his issues and the economy and health care and things like that, and that we'll see the surge in his approval numbers in a couple of months. That's the only thing that could possibly make sense out of any of this. But the funniest joke of the evening, in my opinion, was this joke by the president.
And I'm feeling sorry, believe it or not, for the Speaker of the House as well. These days, the House Republicans actually give John Boehner a harder time than they give me. Which means orange really is the new black.
Now, I don't know who came up with that joke, but whoever did needs some kind of bonus. Whatever they're getting paid, it's not enough. Tying together the hit series Orange is the New Black with Boehner problems with his own caucus and the whole racism undertone of it all, it's perfect. Now, you heard the crowd reaction to it. It was a great joke, but here's the serious aspect to that, and it's not funny at all. Fans of the show will remember when I had Dick Armey on a few months ago and talked about this. And I believe Dick Armey's take on this. He's not in elected office. He has nothing really to gain by not being perfectly straight with me on it. As maddening as Boehner has been to many of us Democrats, he's actually somewhere in the middle, ideology-wise, of where the Republican Party is right now, in my opinion. There are as many Republicans to his left as there are to his right. I think he's extremely level-headed as Republicans go, and Dick Armey agreed with me on that. But the problem is this Tea Party far-right crowd, both the grassroots and the Tea Party far-right representatives in the House, they want him out of the speakership, and they want to replace him with a far-right lunatic. And to give you an example of how bad that could be for this country, if one of those far-right lunatics had been in charge, had been speaker this past fall during that whole budget impasse, during the whole government shutdown, I think the government would still be shut down today. That crowd will refuse to negotiate on just about any position. They'll make governing this country a living hell if one of them becomes speaker. And you know what? It could and likely will happen. Boehner will almost certainly not be able to hang on to his speaker's gavel after this election. Several of his key allies are retiring, and there have been a number of articles analyzing all of this. The Tea Party crazies in the House will have the numbers that they need to unseat him, to unseat Boehner from the speakership. If and when that happens, sane Americans will look wistfully at the time that Boehner was speaker. That's how bad it will get, in my opinion. But But the president was fantastic at the White House Correspondents' Dinner this past Saturday. There were many other jokes that I couldn't play because of time constraints and because some of them, quite frankly, required slides to show. So I encourage you all to look up his presentation on YouTube because it really was that great. We'll be right back. The jobs report came out this past Friday, and it greatly exceeded everyone's expectations. 288,000 jobs were added to the economy this past April. The unemployment rate dropped a staggering 0.4%, from 6.7% to 6.3%. In addition, the March and February job numbers were adjusted, indicating even more jobs were created both of those months than previously thought. The breakdown is that 273,000 jobs were added in the private sector in April and 15,000 in government. USA Today reported that Scott Brown, the chief economist of Raymond James, said that many small businesses have been hesitant to add employees, in part because of concerns about the new health care coverage mandate, but rising demand is increasingly forcing their hand. You're at the point where hiring is really going to start to pick up, he says. Some other labor market indicators in Friday's report were also strong. The number of temporary employees increased by 24,000, possibly heralding further solid gains in permanent workers. A broader measure of job market distress, that includes part-time employees who prefer full-time jobs and those who've given up looking for work, as well as the unemployed, fell to 12.3% from 12.7%. And the number of Americans out of work at least 6 months dropped by 287,000 to 3.5 million. That group still represents 35.5% of all of those unemployed. Many economists expect the economy and job market to accelerate this year because of higher household wealth and reduced debt, as well as a continuing housing recovery and more modest federal government spending cuts. So here we are, 5.5 years into President Obama's time in office, and the economy is really starting to take off. 6.3% unemployment. When he took office, very different story. So one of the things that I wonder is, how soon will Republicans have to admit that he deserves a lot of credit on the economy? He took over. The job market was losing 800,000 jobs a month. Think about that, 800,000 jobs a month. And now we're in the low 6%. It was heading to double-digit unemployment when the president took office. We're at 6.3%. Almost certainly over the next year it'll be under 6%. Might even be under 5% by the time the president leaves office. Contrast that again to at the end of George W. Bush's time in office. We were in a terrible recession, rising unemployment. At the end of George H.W. Bush's time in office, also rising unemployment in recession. So the last two Republican presidents have left in a recession. And we have a Democratic president now who's about to leave in a bull market. The stock market is also up. That's right, over 16,000, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So when are Republicans going to give this president the credit that he deserves? We'll be right back. And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning the Hall of Fame this week for making great sense is Virginia's Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe. During the campaign for governor, then-Democratic nominee McAuliffe made his number one priority to have Virginia take advantage of the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion provision. Virginia is one of 22 states that did not expand Medicaid, as opposed to 26, including the District of Columbia, that did expand Medicaid, and three states that are still mulling it over. McAuliffe won the race. He's now governor of Virginia, and as part of his proposed budget, he added Medicaid expansion to the bill. If Medicaid expansion were to be enacted in Virginia, it would cut in half the number of Virginians without health insurance. It would give 400,000 Virginians health insurance who currently do not have it. And like in other states, the federal government would pay for it. The federal government would pay 100% of Medicaid expansion costs in any state from 2014 to 2017, 95% of costs from 2017 to 2020, and 90% of costs thereafter. Republicans in Virginia have refused to pass the budget bill if Medicaid expansion is part of it, and they're threatening a government shutdown over the issue, state government shutdown. Among other things, Republicans are claiming they don't want to pass the bill because they are claiming the federal government cannot afford to live up to its financial obligations under the bill. But as I said on Fox News a little over a week ago in a debate with my friends Stuart Varney and Mary Catherine Hamm, the Affordable Care Act is paid for by a several percent tax increase on top capital gains earners and by lowering payments to Medicare providers to the tune of $700 billion, as well as a few other measures. Those measures, folks, are raising so much money that they're exceeding additional expenditures of Obamacare by over $200 billion. And thus, and this is all according to the Congressional Budget Office, Obamacare and its money-raising provisions are reducing the deficit by $200 billion. So Virginia adding approximately $2 billion to the expenditures by expanding Medicaid would be a drop in the bucket compared to the excess revenue raised by the Affordable Care Act. Of course, if you've been paying attention, untrue statements by Republicans to attack Obamacare is nothing new, from death panels to killing grandma to undocumented immigrants being covered to all sorts of other nonsense. Whatever they can throw against the wall to see if it sticks, Republicans have done that. At this point, it appears that Governor McAuliffe and his administration are examining whether he can expand Medicaid via executive order. Two state governors have done that already, Kentucky and Ohio, but there were loopholes in those states' laws and state constitutions that allowed those governors to do that. Those loopholes do not exist in Virginia. And if McAuliffe tries to expand Medicaid without the state legislature, Republicans in Virginia have promised to fight him in the courts. The stakes are really high here, folks. Studies have shown that a certain percentage of uninsured people will die each year because of lack of access to health care. Several thousand of those 400,000 uninsured Virginians that would be covered by Medicaid expansion will die this year if it is not expanded. It's likely that, being that this is May, some of them have already died. This full court press by Governor McAuliffe, his administration, and his Democratic allies in the Virginia state legislature is extremely important, and it makes sense. So congratulations to Virginia's Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe for winning our Hall of Fame this week for making great sense. But now we have our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense.
All aboard!
In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have a tie between the 6th Congressional Republican Caucus in Wisconsin and Focus on the Family founder James Dobson. The theme for both of those who placed third this week is unnecessary divisiveness. As reported by David Freelander of the Daily Beast, the Wisconsin Republicans, who comprise the 6th Congressional Republican Caucus in Wisconsin, passed a resolution reaffirming Wisconsin's right to secede from the Union, should it choose to do so, and also would have legalized state nullification of federal laws. Now, Republicans in the rest of the state quickly distanced themselves from the measures. At a general party meeting on Saturday, the resolution containing both measures were voted down by a vote of 303 to 145. Still, that means that nearly a third of Wisconsin State Republican Party members voted for this resolution to reaffirm the right for Wisconsin to secede and nullify federal laws. Folks, if that doesn't underscore the crazy ideological place that Republicans are in right now, I don't know what does. Continuing with our unnecessarily divisive theme, We have James Dobson, the founder of Focus on the Family, who, along with Congresswoman Janice Hahn of California, attended the National Day of Prayer gathering this week on Capitol Hill. For those of you who don't know, the theme of this year's National Day of Prayer was One Voice United in Prayer. And on the webpage for the event, it further solidifies this theme by saying that the biblical verse for this year was Romans 15:6, which reads, "So that with one mind and one voice you may glorify God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ." Now, I'm not saying all of this to get all religious on the show. I am simply laying the groundwork here for what happened. Just so you all get that this year was supposed to be a nonpartisan event for observers to find common ground in prayer. All was fine until James Dobson came to the podium. Dobson's speech included an attack on Planned Parenthood and calling President Obama, quote, "the abortion president." Now, at this, the Daily News reports that Congresswoman Janice Hahn of California, one of the co-chairs of the National Prayer Breakfast, stood up and shouted, "This is completely inappropriate for the National Day of Prayer," and then she stormed out. And asked to comment, she said, "I would hope we could leave our politics at the door," Hahn said. "This was just such an affront to me personally and religiously. It was an affront to everything we are trying to do in Washington, D.C. to not bring politics into our congressional prayer gatherings." Other members, she said, told her later that they also, quote, "felt blindsided by this guy." So great job, Mr. Dobson. You poisoned what should have been a nice day for folks to come together and enjoy praying together. James Dobson and the Wisconsin Republicans of the 6th Congressional Caucus are third this week in our Hall of Shame for Worst Nonsense of the Week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have Russian presidential spokesperson, Press Secretary Dmitry Peskov. Not since Iraq's Tariq Aziz have we seen a spokesperson for another government spew such ridiculous lies and half-truths as Russian Press Secretary Dmitry Peskov. When asked about the pro-Russian militants seizing government buildings and kidnapping people in eastern Ukraine, Mr. Peskov said, "Russia has effectively lost influence over self-defense forces in Ukraine and cannot settle the situation on its own. Western sponsors are making a reservation all the time that self-defense forces in the southeast of the country are armed and show armed resistance. From now on, Russia has effectively lost influence of these people like any other country has, because it will be impossible to persuade them to disarm and end resistance in the face of a direct threat to their life. All of this is driving the situation into a deadlock. Despite its coherent attempts to follow the path of resolution, the path of dialogue, Russia has encountered provocative actions not only from Kiev, but from its Western sponsors as well. Russia cannot handle the settlement process alone, while Kiev and its Western sponsors are effectively provoking bloodshed and bear direct responsibility for that. They must understand that the responsibility lies precisely with them." So let me paraphrase what Mr. Peskov said here. Russia invaded Crimea, destabilizing the entire region, and giving those who are pro-Russian the belief that if you seize a few buildings, the Russian army will come in and support you, Russia will annex your town and your region. But it's the United States, the European Union, and Kiev's government's fault that this is happening, and they need to do something about it because Russia has lost control of the situation. Now, if that doesn't leave your mind absolutely spinning, I don't know what would. You know, first of all, it's a lie that Russia has lost control. Without Russian support, the pro-Russian folks in eastern Ukraine would have no weapons. They'd have no hope of a successful resolution to what they're doing. All Russia has to do is say, "In no case will we ever annex eastern Ukraine, and we support the prosecution of pro-Russian militants in eastern Ukraine, and will help the Ukrainian government in Kiev arrest them using force if necessary." If Russia said that, the entire crisis would end in a few hours. But the Russians are not doing that, of course. They like the destabilization in eastern Ukraine, and they like the problems in the greater region because they don't want the new government in Ukraine to have as much, they want them to have as much difficulty as possible, because that government is not pro-Russian. It's pro-European Union and it's pro-the United States. So this is, as I said in the beginning of this segment, these lies are as ridiculous as those that we heard of Tariq Aziz in Iraq while Saddam Hussein was still in power. They bear no resemblance to reality on the ground at all. Russian Press Secretary Dmitry Peskov is runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. But the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. Before I get into what Senator Graham said about the administration in Benghazi, let me quote from an American blog article a few weeks ago where Republican Representative Howard Buck McKeon, the chair of the House Armed Services Committee, talked about Benghazi. Representative McKeon says he's satisfied with how the U.S. military, and ergo the Obama administration, responded to the deadly attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, that killed four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador to Libya. He said, "I think I've pretty well been satisfied that given where the troops were, how quickly the thing all happened and how quickly it dissipated, we probably couldn't have done more than we did." McKeon then went on to plant a not-so-subtle dig at fellow Republicans who keep harping on Benghazi as if there were a real scandal there. McKeon said, "We've been working on this for a long time. We issued a preliminary report. At some point, when we run out of people to talk to, or we run out of people to talk two or three times to, at some point, we think we'll have as much of the story as we're going to get and move on." Well, this week in a radio appearance, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham talked about Benghazi.
"Our Democratic friends, for the most part, have been in the tank over Benghazi. They think it's to get me reelected. I mean, some guy said this about me yesterday on the left, that the only reason I cared about this was because I've got six Tea Party opponents." Well, if that's true, I'm the biggest scumbag in America. Yeah, the scumbags are the people in the White House who lied about this.
Senator Graham, you talk about Democrats getting on your case, but Representative McKeon is from your party. He's the Republican chair of the House Armed Services Committee, and he says that there's no there. So yes, you're doing this to try to shore up your support from the far right in South Carolina who think you're a rhino, a Republican in name only. That's what this is about. Most of America, including many in your own party, know that the entire Benghazi obsession among some Republicans is nonsense. Again, there's no there. South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham wins the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, May 11th, and Monday, May 12th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Steven Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.